We are exploring this incredibly powerful exhibition catalog from Gallery Matisse.
It's stunning.
It really is. And it's being presented right now at Expo Chicago 2026.
Yeah.
So for those of you attending, or, you know, if you're planning to acquire work, they are set up at booth 221.
Booth 221, right.
We are going to guide you through the works of three truly visionary artists available for acquisition there. That's Devin Allen, Tawny Chapman, and M. Scott Johnson.
It's just a remarkable collection. But, you know, to genuinely understand the weight of these individual pieces,
yeah,
we really have to start with a philosophy that's holding the entire exhibition together.
That makes sense.
It's driven by this curatorial statement from Dr. Matisse Padala. It's titled, Reclaiming the Lens, Memory, Reflection, and Reclamation in Contemporary Black Art.
Reclaiming the lens. You know, the word reclamation feels like the real anchor there. Like, it's not just representation.
Exactly. And Dr. Padala makes a really crucial distinction there.
Okay.
Representation is, well, it's passive. It's just saying, you know, look, we exist in this space.
Right. Just being visible.
Yeah. But reclamation is active. It is an ongoing act of self-definition. She actually frames this entire exhibition as she calls it a counter-archive.
A counter-archive?
Yeah. The intent is to actively resist historical erasure. So these artists are transforming the image, the physical body, and like the very concept of an archive into these vessels for survival, divinity, and renewal.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Sure.
Because that term counterarchive, I mean, that is doing a lot of conceptual work.
It really is.
When I think of a traditional archive, I think of this highly controlled ecosystem. Like a dusty museum basement, right?
Oh, actually, exactly.
It's an institutional record where whoever holds the keys basically decides what gets filed away as history and what gets, you know, thrown in the trash.
Right. Written by the victors.
Exactly. So I'm struggling with this a bit. How exactly does a piece of modern art function as a counterarchive? Like, are we literally trying to change the facts of the past or just how we feel about them?
Well, you're hitting on the exact tension there. It's not about altering facts, right? It's about altering the lens through which those facts are recorded and remembered.
Okay, I see.
Because the traditional archive, it often categorized or marginalized or just outright erased certain communities.
Right.
So a counterarchive forces a disruption. It demands that the subject be seen entirely on their own terms. Dr. Badala's vision is that memory and imagination must coalesce.
Coalesce meaning they blend together?
Yeah, you take the fragments of historical consciousness and you fuse them with this visionary reimagination. You are actively healing the narrative of the past to, like, protect the dignity of the future.
Healing the narrative. Wow. That actually provides the perfect transition to our first artist.
Devin Allen.
Yes, Devin Allen. He is reclaiming the lens by giving us this unvarnished, hyper-present documentation of reality.
He really is.
Devin is a self-taught photographer from Baltimore, and he actually rocketed to international acclaim when his photography landed on the cover of Time magazine.
Right, and his work is so vital because it provides this stark counter-narrative to how Baltimore, and specifically its Black residents, are typically portrayed in the mainstream media.
Right, because usually the news lens only focuses on, like, crisis or statistics.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Allen bypasses all of that entirely. He captures the absolute complexity, the quiet moments, and, you know, the nuanced textures of everyday Black life.
And what's immediately striking for a collector looking at this catalog is the physical medium he chooses.
Oh, the scale is incredible.
Right. These aren't your standard 8x10 prints on glossy photo paper. He prints these street photographs on massive canvases.
Yeah.
Let's actually look at the specific works available at Booth 221, starting with a 2023 piece called Around Doughway Cowgirl.
From the Textures of Us series.
Exactly.
It is a visually arresting piece. You have this striking black and white portrait of a rider seated on a grazing horse.
Yeah.
But they aren't in a rural field.
Yeah.
You know, they are set right in the middle of a dense urban landscape.
The collision of those two worlds is just amazing. You have this incredibly confident posture from the writer, like a real memorable self-possession.
Mm.
And then overhead, there are these sweeping tree branches spreading across the upper field of the image, and it kind of softens the harsh city architecture.
It does. It gives the whole composition this sweeping visual rhythm.
Yeah. And then from that same Textures of Us series, we have Untitled 6.
Right. Created in 2021.
The framing here shifts pretty dramatically, doesn't it?
It really does. It's an intimate portrait of a young subject inside a car, and they're turning back to look directly toward the camera.
It feels like a still from an indie film.
Yes.
With the dark upholstery, the soft reflections on the glass, the emotional accessibility is just profound. You feel like you just caught someone's eye at a stoplight, but the moment stretches out.
It's a very lingering moment.
And then we have to talk about Untitled 7 from 2023.
Oh, that one is a towering canvas.
It's huge. 60 by 40 inches, and that's unframed.
Yeah, it features a standing figure in a broad streetscape, holding a cane, one hand resting on their hip, with their chin just slightly raised.
Such a powerful stance.
The grayscale palette in that piece does incredible work, too. It heightens the texture of the subject's clothing and the raw pavement beneath them.
Right.
But more importantly, the dignity in that stance is just absolute. Like, it carries the visual authority of a major historical portrait.
Which actually brings me to a question I have about his process.
Okay.
I get that the images are powerful, but does taking these street scenes off standard photo paper and putting them on these massive painterly canvases actually change the art? Or is it just making the image louder, so to speak?
No, it fundamentally changes the art.
How so?
Because scale is a vocabulary of its own. When you take a fleeting moment on a Baltimore street and print it on a 60-inch canvas, you are forcefully moving it from the realm of snapshot into the realm of the monumental.
Ah, I see.
Canvas implies permanence. It implies the museum, the royal portrait, the historical record.
Right, it's institutional almost.
Exactly. Allen is giving everyday people material presence and sculptural quality. He is telling the viewer, this person is monumental. They are worthy of taking up space. It forces you to literally look up to them.
Wow. Okay, so Devin Allen is elevating the raw, unvarnished present.
Yes.
But our next artist, Tawny Chapman, is doing something entirely different with this idea of the counter archive.
She is. She's reaching backwards.
Right. She physically alters photographs to confront and basically rewrite historical stereotypes.
Chapman's practice is a deeply tactile engagement with cultural memory. She uses archival pigment prints as her base, but she doesn't stop there.
Not at all.
No, she expands into these incredibly intricate material processes. Mm-hmm. Hand embroidery, acrylic paint, and mixed media layered directly over the photographs.
And we really have to highlight a major ethical shift she made in her materials because I think it speaks volumes about her as an artist.
It absolutely does.
Historically, Chapman used genuine 24-karat gold leaf in her work. She was heavily inspired by Byzantine icons and artists like Gustav Klimt, right? Mm-hmm. She used gold to signal that her black subjects were sacred and precious.
Yes, but she became acutely aware of the devastating ethical and human toll associated with mining genuine gold and cobalt.
Specifically in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, right?
Exactly. She realized that she couldn't honor the dignity of her subjects using materials that were sourced through exploitation.
That makes total sense.
So she made the conscious decision to just abandon genuine gold entirely. Now she uses gold-toned pigments and paper remnants to achieve that exact same radiant, venerated effect.
That alignment of ethics and aesthetics is just incredible to me.
It really is.
And the works available for acquisition are breathtaking. Let's look at the Reconciliation Economic Heritage from 2024.
Conceptually, this piece is a masterclass.
Tell me about it.
The photograph features this calm, unwavering figure dressed in red and black. They're seated and holding a watermelon, surrounded by roses.
A watermelon. Now that's a very loaded symbol.
It is, and that's the point. This piece is part of a larger reclamation of culinary traditions. Historically, certain foods were weaponized through racist caricatures.
Right, tropes that were meant to demean.
Exactly. Chapman is stripping away that distortion and restoring these foods to their rightful context,
which is
as sources of nourishment, agricultural skill, family connection, and economic survival.
And her use of adornment is what really anchors it for me. The deep atmospheric background, the patterned textiles.
Yeah.
The adornment isn't just decorative excess. It acts as architectural structure for the entire image.
That's a great way to put it.
Which directly connects to another series available at the booth called The Restoration.
Right. In The Restoration, Chapman takes aim at the most harmful historical caricatures. Tropes like the mammy.
Yeah.
These were calculated post-Reconstruction fabrications designed to demean black people and sanitize the horrors of servitude.
So how does she counter that?
She takes those figures, repaints them, reclothes them, and places them within compositions that grant them absolute honor and autonomy.
There's a piece from this series called Not Your Mammy from 2025-26.
No, it's stunning.
The figure is clothed in these luminous flowing white garments with the sculptural headpiece.
Mm-hmm.
The palette is so restrained, too. It's just pure white and gold. The subject has their hands folded, radiating this quiet, unshakable authority.
Yeah, but then right next to it, you have, tell them the truth about the The Watermelon Man, which is just an explosion of energy.
Oh, the contrast is brilliant.
It is. That piece has this undeniable theatrical beauty to it. The seated figure wears a richly patterned crimson garment and an extravagant floral hat that shades the face.
It creates this dramatic crown of color.
Exactly. And the gold embellishment across the bodice gives it tremendous visual style and immense wall presence.
Let's also look at iconography. Our sun sets to rise again.
Yes.
The subject in this one is viewed from behind, wearing a simple hooded jacket and jeans. But Chapman places them against this glowing, radiant field of mosaic-like marks that mimic ancient Byzantine icons.
She uses paper, denim, and mother-of-pearl shell to make the background literally shimmer.
It's beautiful.
She's playing with the visual language of reverence. Historically, Byzantine mosaics were reserved for saints and deities.
Right.
By placing a contemporary black figure in a hoodie against that sacred backdrop, she is forcing the viewer to ask, who gets to decide who is worthy of veneration?
Here's where it gets really interesting for me, though.
Okay.
We mentioned earlier that she hand embroiders these pieces. She physically pierces the archival print with a needle and thread.
She does.
I have to admit, piercing a finished photograph feels inherently destructive.
I can see why you'd say that.
Why take a needle and stab the art? How does that tactile intervention act as a restoration?
That is actually the genius of her method. Yeah. A photograph, by definition, is a flat, fixed surface. It traps a moment in time. By taking a needle and thread and piercing that surface, Chetmon is refusing to let the moment remain trapped. Think about the cultural history of embroidery and sewing.
Like mending clothes.
Exactly. It is universally associated with mending, with care, and with generations of passed down knowledge. By physically sewing into the image, she isn't destroying it. She is literally mending the historical narrative.
Oh, wow.
It is an act of repair that you can actually reach out and touch.
Mending the narrative with a needle and thread, that is just brilliant.
It really is.
Okay, so we've explored Allen's monumental framing of the present and Chapman's tactile mending of the past.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we are shifting from flat surfaces into fully three-dimensional space with our final artist, M. Scott Johnson. He brings rhythmic form to solid stone.
Johnson is a sculptor, and his practice is utterly unique.
Tell us about it.
His work is heavily influenced by his coming of age in Detroit, specifically within the Sonic Laboratory of Detroit Techno.
Detroit Tech.
Yeah. He translates the machinic rhythm, the electronic loop, and the pulse of that music directly into his stone carving. He actually calls this practice Afro-Surrealist Materialism.
Okay, stop.
What?
Detroit Techno and solid marble.
I know.
How does an electronic music loop translate into a rock? I'm having a hard time visualizing how a pulsing, futuristic sound becomes a heavy, ancient-looking sculpture.
It makes sense when you look at what Detroit techno actually is, conceptually.
Okay, explain.
It was born from industrial decay.
Oh.
Taking the machines that marginalized workers and using them to create a futuristic, soulful escape.
Right.
Johnson does the exact same thing with stone. He takes this dense, ancient material and carves it with these repetitive, rhythmic, geometric pulses. His sculptures collapse the distance between ancestral invocation and futuristic speculation.
Let's look at the specific works at Booth 221 to see how this materializes.
Good.
He has these monumental pieces, starting with foundational Black American Conjure Tablet, #1 from 2026.
Yeah, it's a carved desk made of Jerusalem gold marble.
And what he embeds into that marble is fascinating. You have this asymmetrical arrangement of carnelian, onyx, turquoise, gold leaf, and pieces of Haijon the Conqueror root.
Yes.
Wait, back up. What exactly is a Haijon the Conqueror root, and why would you put it inside a marble tablet?
Haijon the Conqueror is a staple of African-American folk magic and hoodoo.
Okay.
Historically, it's a root associated with luck, personal power, and the evasion of capture. It's a deeply potent symbol of survival and resistance.
Wow.
So Johnson is taking high classical materials like Jerusalem gold marble and injecting it with raw, organic folk magic.
That perfectly balances ceremonial presence with contemporary refinement.
It really does.
He also has foundational Black American Conjure Tablet, #2. This one expands the visual drama significantly, I think.
Oh, definitely.
It's a dynamic, circular form set on a tall support rising from a bold red and black base.
The graphic force of that second tablet is just immense. The red base intensifies the verticality, giving it this towering architectural authority.
Yeah.
And again, the embedded stones are deeply intentional. The carnelian evokes vitality, the onyx offers grounding, and the turquoise connects back to indigenous cosmologies.
We also have to highlight a slightly older but deeply poignant piece available at the booth. His headstone for Queen Elizabeth Catlett, created in 2012.
A beautiful piece.
It's carved from black Belgian marble. It has these deeply carved, flowing contours. The polished black marble catches the light, giving it a quiet intensity and a deeply lyrical, memorial quality.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to push back on his concept of the tablets for a second.
Go for it.
Historically, a tablet, whether it's the Ten Commandments or Hammurabi's Code, it's designed to be read.
Right.
It is the ultimate symbol of fixed, immovable law. But Johnson specifically insists that his conjure tablets were never meant to be read. They are meant to be worked.
Yes.
But it's a massive piece of heavy marble. How does it perform a ritual or work? Isn't it just sitting there as a symbol?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture of the counter-archive that Dr. Bedolla outlined, Johnson's intent becomes pretty clear.
Okay, how so?
He is deliberately destabilizing the Western idea of a monument. A Western tablet is a text to be passively obeyed.
Right.
But by embedding organic material like the High John the Conqueror route, Johnson turns the marble into an active technology.
An active technology.
Yeah, it's a vessel for diasporic knowledge. The carved stone holds the visible pattern, but the embedded root holds the spirit, the fugitive knowledge. It requires your engagement, your energy. It refuses to be a dead relic. It is an ongoing performance of cultural memory.
So it's a living archive.
Exactly.
That completely changes how you interact with the sculpture, which actually brings us to the most crucial part for you listening right now.
Yeah.
How do these powerful counter-archives find their way out of the exhibition and into private collections?
Well, that is the ultimate goal of the exhibition. Acquiring these works isn't just about, you know, adding aesthetics to a room.
Not at all.
It is an opportunity to literally become a custodian of this history. Galerie Mertiz has really established itself as a pivotal institution for African-American and African diasporic artists, championing works that foster critical dialogue on identity, history, and social justice.
Absolutely.